So I thought I'd read from Ajahn Buddhadasa. Looking within is extremely important for an understanding of Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha. This is because the Buddha was concerned exclusively with things within, and his teaching is an account of what is to be seen when we look within. Looking at the inner life, the life within, is what the Dhamma is all about. We have to look within if we are to be able to couple the Dhamma with our life, or to make the Dhamma one with our life. But why speak of a without and a within? All things have two sides, an outside and an inside, a without and a within. There is a word in philosophy, and in ordinary usage too, the word quintessence. Quint means fifth. Essence means true nature or core. Quintessence means fifth essence. Philosophers used to speak of four outward essences, the elements earth, water, fire, and air. These four were without. The fifth essence was not earth, water, fire, or air, but something else again, something within, namely consciousness, the mental side of things. So it is this fifth element or essence that we have to come to understand properly and fully. Buddhism also recognizes a sixth essence, a sixth element. The first four elements are earth, water, fire, and air, and the fifth is the mind, the element of consciousness. The sixth element is the void, the element of voidness, also called Nibbana. So we have six elements, earth, water, fire, air, mind, and voidness. Mind and voidness are the fifth and sixth essences. They lie deep inside. They are the within. The looking within, then, to which we are referring, means looking at the mind, in particular the mental construction of me and mine, which is the cause of all action, good and bad. This is one aspect of the Dhamma. The sixth essence is the state that is void of the idea of being me or belonging to me, in other words, void of all defilements. To be free of defilements is to be free of suffering, free of all things that bring about suffering. That all these six things should be regarded as basic elements, dhatu, is completely sound. However, most of us probably consider this classification unfounded because we are only aware of the elements of earth, water, fire, and air, or, in a more modern perspective, the elements of chemistry. The mind and even more profound dimensions of existence are not considered elements. The word element, as used here, refers to things that really do exist, nothing more than that. Things without really do exist without, and the things within, which lie so deep that they cannot be seen, really exist within. These deeper lying elements are to be counted as essences of which all things are composed. For the sake of clarity, I should add a few further words of explanation. In discussions of the principles of Buddhism, it is often stated that there are ultimately only three elements: the form element, the formless element, and the cessation element, rupa, arupa, nirodha dhatu. Of these terms, the first, the form element, refers to the physical elements which shape or mass, which can be seen, smelled, or felt. These taken together comprise the form element. The second, formless element, refer to things that lack this kind of form, but which nonetheless have real existence, things that can be known only through the mind, because they themselves are of the mind. These taken together comprise the formless element. The third, cessation element, nirodha dhatu, has real existence too, but it consists of the cessation of the remaining elements. It cannot be said to have form or to lack form, because it is beyond both form and formlessness, which is why the Buddha called it the cessation element, the Nibbana element, or the element of the void, sunyata. Please bear in mind this broader meaning of the term element. Here it means much more than it does in the physical sciences, where it covers only the states of matter and energy or the chemical elements. All of the elements of science are covered by the form element alone. The Buddha's teaching on this subject reveals the existence of hidden realities visible to enlightened beings, and to the Buddha in particular. For the Buddha, the formless element and the cessation element were ordinary, easily comprehended matters, which he knew about just as we know about earth, water, fire, and air, or about the 100-odd chemical elements that scientists have discovered. We must then set up a new and more refined way of thinking in which the term element has this wider meaning. The less obvious elements can be perceived only if we look within. We will thereby understand the teaching of the Buddha, a person who is adept at looking within. Looking within can be explained in terms of two ordinary everyday words, which, however, are also special terms in the language of philosophy, the antonyms objectivity and subjectivity. Strictly speaking, objectivity refers to the condition that obtains when we are looking at or taking account of purely physical objects and actions. Subjectivity refers to the condition that obtains when we are looking at or experiencing mental things, and when we are looking at the doer rather than what is being done. The objective side is the physical side, the object, that which is done. The subjective side is the mental side, the mind or doer, as opposed to what is done. This all becomes much clearer if we go by the original meanings of the Pali terms. The word citta, denoting the mind or the subjective side, translates literally as builder, doer, knower, that which leads away other things. Rupa, denoting the physical or objective side, is literally that which is built, that which is easily broken up or destroyed, that which is known or led away or done. We have to look at the subjective side, the mind, the doer, rather than at what is done. To go foolishly looking only at the objective side focuses on the action rather than the actor, with the inevitable consequence that one becomes a slave of objects or objectively perceived elements. By contrast, to look at the subjective side, we become aware of the mind of the actor and the doer, and hence gain freedom from the controlling power of sense objects. Looking within gives us this freedom. From the time of our birth, we have lacked proper training in Dhamma. We have sunk into materialism, become infatuated with physical things. We have looked only at the physical or objective side of reality. We must make a new resolution to practice looking at the subjective side of things until we are able to make the state of things within, the inward side, reveal itself to us in all clarity, so that it is no longer a hidden mystery to us. Let me clarify further this matter of looking without and looking within in terms of the most ordinary everyday words. Looking without and looking within are opposites, but the without and the within are inseparable because things within are dependent on things without. For example, the body is the basis or dwelling place of the mind. The mind depends on the body. Body and mind are inseparable, and yet we can distinguish them as outer and inner, respectively. It is just like a piece of fruit which has outer rind and inner flesh, dependent on each other and inseparable. If we look only without, we would see only the inedible rind. But if we look within, we find the flesh, the part that is good to eat. Looking within is essential, but we should not be one-eyed about it as to reject the without. We have to recognize the value of the outer shell, the without, as in the case of fruit. If fruit has no rind or skin, the inner flesh could not exist. The rind is essential, but to think that the rind was everything would be utterly stupid. To look without is to see only the outer shell. To look within is to see the real core. If we only look without, we are slaves of objects, but if we look within, we become masters of objects, all the shapes, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile sensations that exist. As long as the mind is allowed to wander uncontrolled under the influence of the outward looking, it is a slave to objects. But as soon as the mind truly looks within, it becomes free from their influence. Looking without prevents us from understanding Dhamma, while looking within enables us to understand it. Dhamma is hidden by the without. In saying that the Dhamma is hidden, I mean it is as difficult to see as if it were hidden. To put it simply, we are deluded, infatuated, pig-headed, stupid, worldly, thick, or however you care to describe it. In the language of Dhamma, this condition is called avijja, ignorance. The sense of me and mine is located deep within where we do not ordinarily see it. However, if we practice looking within using the method taught by the Buddha, it will reveal itself to us as clearly as the things without. Looking within will reveal in all clarity that the sense of me and mine alone is the cause of all our chronic suffering. So, me and mine must be eliminated using the right technique, for example, starving it so it becomes emaciated and dies of itself, like an animal penned up without food. We might put it this way: that to look without is to be stuck in materialism, while to look within is the way of mentalism. Materialism and mentalism are opposites. Looking without inevitably brings the fruits of materialism, slavery to material things and endless problems. Today's problems are largely rooted in materialism. No matter who is fighting whom, each side is fighting for material gain or advantage. Each may hold to its own particular variety of materialism, crude or refined, extreme, unmitigated, thoroughgoing materialism, or a subtle, fine, barely discernible materialism, but both are, nevertheless, equally infatuated with materialism. Only by overcoming this obsession with materialism and becoming more concerned with non-material values will the present world crises be resolved. In this way, war will be eliminated and a higher state of well-being, which we might call an age of enlightenment, will dawn. The cost of merely looking without is suffering. The value of looking within is penetrating the Buddha Dhamma and the realization of supreme happiness. This happiness is beyond materialism and, in this sense, is transcendent. This distinction between looking without and looking within can also be described in terms of two kinds of language: everyday language, which refers to people and things, the material side, and truth or Dhamma language, which refers to the Dhamma and the mind. Take the term wealth, for example. There are two kinds of wealth, worldly or outer wealth, and inner wealth, the wealth of an enlightened being. Jewels, rings, silver and gold, lands, fields, elephants, horses, cattle, fame and power, all these you know very well as outer or worldly wealth. As for inner wealth, the wealth of enlightened beings, that is Dhamma in the sense of the cessation of suffering. Worldly or outer wealth consists of things with which we have become infatuated, while inner wealth, the wealth of enlightened beings, is the wealth that can be perceived only with a mind that is refined and capable of looking deeply within. The relative value of these two has often been described. We shall just use one example. Outer wealth is not an essential part of our being. It can be stolen or destroyed by fire and other disasters, so it is not really ours. And what is more, outer wealth is potentially harmful to us. Often it turns on us, creating difficulties and hardships. By contrast, inner wealth, the wealth of enlightened beings, is free of these properties. It never does harm. It never makes people weep, and probably never makes people laugh either, because weeping and laughing cannot be compared with freedom, voidness, and equanimity. The wealth of enlightenment brings only stillness and coolness. We gain it through mindful awareness, penetrating through exterior appearances to the reality within. This is a special kind of wealth, wealth that is unique to followers of the Buddhist way. We can consider illness in the same way. A person who sees only the without fears only physical illness, bodily ailments, diseases, aches, and pains. We are quite unaware of the existence of non-physical illness, mental disorders, which are far more dangerous, and we are unaware that common bodily ailments are often really a result of mental disorders. For example, certain intestinal complaints are recognized by doctors and medicinal researchers as a result of prolonged anxiety or mental stress. Mental ailment comes first in the form of anxiety. This anxiety results from mistaken ideas, false views regarding things of the world. These false views lead one to grasp and cling in a way that causes anxiety, mental illness, and finally physical illness. Speaking more generally, when the mind is in poor condition, the body's power to resist infection is diminished, so that even slight exposure to infection can lead to serious illness. Mental strength and well-being are the foundation for resistance to physical illness. The only medicine needed to control mental disorders is Dhamma. With Dhamma, 99% of illness could be eliminated. An equally close connection pertains between looking within and true happiness. In the Buddhist texts, there are two kinds of happiness. One of these is found in home life, called geha nisita sukha, the kind of happiness that derives from being a householder and raising a family. This is external happiness, with which we are quite familiar. Contrasted with outward happiness is nekama nisita sukha, literally, the happiness that comes from forsaking the home life. The reference is to mental forsaking, a state of mind in which there is no longer the idea of, quote, my home, unquote. This kind of happiness comes from looking within, observing things according to the Dhamma. The happiness of home life is called lokiya sukha, or worldly happiness, and the happiness that goes beyond home life is called lokuttara sukha, or transcendent happiness. It all depends on the state of mind. If a person's mind is worldly, he can stay in a monastery or in the forest, but will attain nothing more than the happiness of home life. The solitude in a monastery or any other place cannot guarantee lokuttara sukha. This happiness depends on the ability to look within. No matter where we are, we have the power to transcend a preoccupation with the world, above and beyond the home, simply by looking within. There is a large guaranteed return. Without any outlay of capital, we obtain this special happiness which appreciates continuously. As the Buddha said, Nibbana costs nothing, we pay nothing for it. All we have to do is throw away. If we will just throw everything away, we get Nibbana. This means simply having a mind high enough not to remain stuck in the world. That is all there is to it. We throw away the world completely and get Nibbana in return. We do not have to invest anything. We only have to be empty to live rightly, and Nibbana will come of itself. The danger of always looking without is that we get a distorted view of things. It is like a person who sees a snake as a fish and picks it up unaware of the danger. A similar expression in Thai Buddhism is the saying, quote, seeing a toothed wheel as a lotus flower, unquote. That is, seeing evil as good. This saying comes from the story of a man who saw a demon with a toothed wheel like a saw blade on his head spraying blood about. Mistaking it for a lotus, he begged to have it placed on his own head and was killed. When we say some people mistake a snake for a fish or a toothed wheel for a lotus, we mean that by misperceiving the nature of things, we become enslaved and are worse off than if we were in prison or suffering the torments of hell. Let us continue to explore the meaning of looking within in regard to how we understand the following concepts: Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, hell and heaven, Nibbana, religion, beauty, goodness, truth, and justice. We shall look first at Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. A foolish man considers the act of reciting them as simple as peeling a banana. You just recite, Buddhang, Dhammang, Sanghang, Saranang, Chami. I take refuge in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, in the Sangha. But, of course, this is not the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha at all, merely a superficial outer shell. Suppose we want to see or reach the Buddha. If a person looks without, he may identify a Buddha image as the Buddha, or he may think of that compassionate human being who lived in India over 2,000 years ago as the Buddha. Both would be mistaken. The Buddha strongly condemned that kind of ignorance. He said, to see the Dhamma is to see the Buddha. To see the Buddha is to see the Dhamma. To see the Buddha, it was not sufficient just to see an image or physical body. Even among the Buddha's contemporaries, people born right in at the same town of Kapilavatthu, there were a great many who never saw the real Buddha. They saw only an outer shell and did not recognize the real Buddha. Many of us are like this, and we pass our wrong views on to our children and those less well-educated and informed than ourselves. Is it right to look for the Buddha in the Buddha image, or in the physical body of the man who lived and wandered about in India all those years ago? We must look for him in the void, the condition void of me and mine, in perfect purity, enlightenment, and peace in which the mind of the Buddha constantly dwelt, that is to say, in the Dhamma. To see the Dhamma is to see the Buddha. To see the Buddha is to see the Dhamma. As for the Dhamma, if we look within, we are in a position to perceive it as a source of joy to the mind. But if we look without, we lose ourselves in the books and manuscripts of the Tipitaka, in the sound of monks chanting or preaching, which is thought of as the sound of the Dhamma, or in rites and rituals, the outward postures of Dhamma practice. Even the practice of meditation may be a kind of external posturing. We lose ourselves in the postures of Dhamma and fail to penetrate to the Dhamma itself. The essence of the Dhamma, the real Dhamma, is a condition of freedom from me and mine, a condition of complete purity, enlightenment, and peace identical with the mental condition attained by the Buddha himself. From an outer or external point of view, the Sangha is simply a group of individuals, so-and-so's son or grandson ordained at this or that monastery and having this or that title. Or worse, some identify the Sangha with anyone dressed in yellow robes. Many relate to the Sangha in this superficial way. For example, some people take a dislike to certain monks and then disparage the entire monastic order. They do not realize that the Sangha is not to be identified with yellow robes or even with the individuals ordained as monks. In the most profound sense, the Sangha is the Dhamma, freed from me and mine, the condition of complete or nearly complete purity, enlightenment, and peace. Anyone who has looked deeply within and perceived the truth of the matter knows that the real Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are not three different things, but are really one and the same. Outwardly they differ, but in essence they are one, the condition of freedom from selfhood, purity, enlightenment, and peace without contamination. This is what we call voidness. As stated in the scriptures, in terms of externals, Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha are three different things. In terms of absolute truth, in their real nature, they are one. Heaven and hell are likewise usually viewed in only physical terms from an outward perspective. People are interested in hell as depicted in temple murals with its various kinds of torments. In fact, these were originally nothing other than the 30-odd forms of punishment meted out to criminals in India at the time of the Buddha. You can read about them in the history books. At least at the time of Asoka, criminals were punished in this way. Artists, therefore, depicted the worst of these forms of punishment in their illustrations of hell. But hell so perceived, depicted as a prison, is hell seen by people looking without. It does not burn the mind like the hell within. The hell within is stupidity, greed, anger, delusion, desire, hatred, fear, worry, and anxiety. These constitute a hell that is much more to be feared, a kind of hell much more difficult to avoid. The hells painted on temple walls can be dismissed as something we do not need to be concerned about, but no one can ignore the real hell, the hell within. If we look within and really examine it, we discover how it really is. It burns us without any sign of fire. It ties us up, binds us, and ensnares us without appearing to. This is the real hell. The hell we see when we look within, the hell we can overcome by the practice of Dhamma. The same is true of heaven. In essence, heaven is the state of contentment or non-striving. The heaven depicted on temple walls is just another case of addiction to external forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile sensations, a total subjection to sense objects. A heaven, calculated in material terms, burns us with anxiety. It is the kind of happiness that roasts us till we are well done. There is nothing peaceful and cool about it. True contentment consists in knowing how to be satisfied with what we have. People who do not know how to be content with what they have are in hell. They are perpetual paupers, even if they are millionaires. Nibbana is also often misconceived in materialistic terms. We often hear people say that they want to be reborn after death in the land of gems or in the land of immortality. They think of Nibbana as a definite place made of gems, gold, and other precious things. Sometimes they confuse Nibbana with the Western paradise of the Hindus and Mahayanists. Some people equate Nibbana with heaven, but 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times better. This is what comes from thinking of Nibbana in external, physical, or materialistic terms. In reality, Nibbana is voidness, the epitome of purity, enlightenment, and peace, because it is the absence of all mental defilements and suffering. Religion is often identified only with temples, rites, and rituals, but these are all just outer forms, fragments of the tangible, material side of religion, not religion in essence, or what the Buddha meant by religion. The word religion, as used by the Buddha, referred to three things: knowledge, practice in accordance with that knowledge, and the purity, enlightenment, and peace that come as the fruit of that practice. These three together are religion, sasana. In Pali they are called Pariyatti Dhamma, Patipatti Dhamma, and Patiweda Dhamma. Dhamma is theory, practice, and attainment. Other, more general terms that illustrate the meaning of looking within are beauty, truth, and justice. we now turn to them. Physical beauty is easy enough to understand. Some people make their living from a beautiful body. They are concerned about bodily beauty or buying and selling products to gain such beauty. That is physical beauty seen in terms of the body. Then there are people who consider beauty to be the possession of wealth or possession of knowledge in the form of degrees and diplomas. They are concerned with physical or material signs of beauty, what you see when you look without. Real beauty, however, is something within, something in the mind. If the beauty of Dhamma is present in a person, then that person is beautiful. That person possesses the beauty of Dhamma in thought, word, and deed. This has nothing at all to do with external appearance, with wealth, or with a certain level of education. A person with this kind of beauty is beautiful in every way. Now let us consider truth. Each of us has eyes, ears, a nose, a tongue, and a touch-sensitive body, so that we judge things as true according to the senses. Material things can be tested and verified. Worldly truth, which has nothing to do with Dhamma, is a matter of what one sees or feels to be true. But objects and conditioned physical relationships are subject to change. What is true one moment may not be true the next. Even the laws of science are subject to change, as scientists well know. A law, which at one point in time is firmly believed to be true, is later found not to be true and so is thrown out. This is because the truth at any particular point in time is a function of our ability to perceive and of our resources for testing and verifying. This is worldly truth, the kind of truth that has nothing to do with the Dhamma. The truth within does not change. In trying to get at this truth, we should concentrate our attention on the most important matter of all, namely, the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Nothing surpasses this truth. There are countless other truths, but all pale before this teaching of the Buddha, which is why he said, "One thing only do I teach, suffering and the cessation of suffering." Finally, we turn to justice or rightness. In this world, it is sometimes the case that might is right, or that expediency is right, or that the evidence given by a witness is made the basis for rightness and justice. But if the witness is lying or mistaken regarding the accuracy of the evidence, then the supposed justice based on it is totally deceptive. Real justice can be based only on Dhamma. Justice based on worldly criteria is worldly justice. It is always only outward and relative. On the other hand, justice based on Dhamma is totally independent of human error. It is absolute. Examples are the law of Kama and laws of impermanence, anicca, suffering, dukkha, and not-self, anatta. The truths of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering, these are absolute and totally just. They favor no one. No one has any special privileges in regard to them. They are laws of nature, and they apply absolutely. I have sought to distinguish between looking without and looking within. Which way shall we look? Which has more value? Genuine faith in the Dhamma and the Buddha is nothing but looking within, and, in particular, eliminating inner suffering. This kind of peace cannot be accomplished with sacred objects, rites and rituals, or through the power of holy men. It is to be realized through Dhamma. The real Dhamma is truth. We do not call it sacred. The word sacred is quite inadequate. Dhamma is more than just sacred in an outward sense. We must give up sacred things, sacred rituals, sacred people, and so on. If we go on being infatuated with the external forms of the sacred, we will miss out on the most sacred and efficacious thing of all, namely Dhamma. If we go on losing ourselves in objects, in externals, in the mere shell of things, we will never get to the real inner core. We will always be eating just the rind of the fruit and never its flesh. We will never taste any of the most refreshing food and that nature has provided for us. This is the value and the merit of looking within. It takes us to the fifth essence, or better still, the sixth essence, which is voidness. To look within is to penetrate to the inner core, the center of everything, and ultimately to be one with the void, freed from me and mine. This is the benefit of knowing how to look within.
What's the title of the book?
Me and Mine. And this one might be hard to read because someone's highlighted the heck out of it. and written, scribbled all over the writing. And but that particular one was readable.
Do you recall when Ajahn Buddhadasa died?
93 or something? Something like that. And I assume this was translated by Ajahn Sandikaro, but it doesn't say anywhere who it was translated by. It just says, edited with an introduction by Donald Swearer. So it's maybe it's essays translated by Ajahn Sandikaro and collected by somebody else and put into this book format.
Have any of the Ajahn spent any time at Swan Lok? What is it that they did for him? I think it was important that he went down there for a very short time.
After Ajahn Chah's death, Lungpur Liam spent 6 months at Suan Mok, and that's where he got the present-day Wat Pa Pong chanting from. It's a copy of the Suan Mok chanting book, because they never had translations of the Pali into Thai. But Ajahn Buddhadasa did all those translations. Yeah, I think so. Because he died 1 or 2 or 3 years after Ajahn Chah, I think. A lot, yeah. Yeah, he's incredible respect for Ajahn Buddhadasa. Yeah. Lungpur Liam, they have this annual calendar, this Ajahn Buddhadasa calendar, that comes out, and it's always got a poem, because Ajahn Buddhadasa would write poetry. So it's got a poem on each month. And at the beginning of each month, Lungpur Liam takes that calendar and reads the poem and commentates on it at the beginning of every month.
I got the impression that maybe there's a retract. Yeah, a retract one.
Okay, let's practice.